Welcome to today's Indiana Chamber of Commerce Policy Issue Conference Call, hosted by Mr. Tom Schuman. During the presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. If you have a question at any point during today's presentation, please press 01. Again, to ask a question, press 01 at any time. And thank you for your attention. At this time, I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Tom Schuman.
Thank you, and welcome to our second policy issue conference call of 2017. I have the entire Indiana Chamber advocacy team with us today to let you know what's going on at the State House on important legislation that's impacting your business. Our team obviously stays busy throughout the session, much of that time at the State House, Monday through Thursday, but they are very busy on Friday. Two members of our team are heading out to some additional meetings and opportunities in coming minutes, so we're going to cover a couple of those issues first, but of course we'll open it up to your questions anytime throughout the next hour. Simply 01 on your phone or tweet using ICC Chamber. Using at Indiana Chamber for your tweets. We're starting with a couple high-profile pieces of legislation. First, we'll talk transportation infrastructure funding. Mark Lawrence, there was a lengthy, and I emphasize the word lengthy, House hearing since we last spoke about nine days ago on that hearing. Give us a little bit of a sense of the outcome of that and what the next steps are on transportation funding.
Good morning. Thank you, Tom. House Bill 1002, which is the road funding bill that the House is presently considering, which would create a long-term, sustainable funding mechanism for Indiana's roads for the future. I could go through some of the key elements, but the big things here are basically a 10-cent per gallon increase in the gas tax, a gradual phase-in of the sales tax that's presently collected on fuels that would be by 2021 fully go to the dedicated road funding rather than the general fund, and there are some other aspects of the bill, but those are a couple of the main things. As you mentioned, there was a really long, extensive hearing, mostly supporters there, but there are some folks, I would say, who are more anti-tax people that have differing ideas on how it's funded. I think there's general agreement on the need for Indiana's roads and infrastructure to get in better shape and that we need to recognize it. I think really the bigger disagreement is about how it gets done. So it was voted out of the Roads and Transportation Committee, but the committee was also attended by members of the House Ways and Means Committee. Next Wednesday, the bill, basically after it was voted out of Roads and Transportation, was given to Ways and Means, and they wanted to give it a couple weeks just to get some other thoughts and ideas about what could be done. And they're going to have a hearing on it next week. I believe it's going to be Wednesday afternoon. To consider the bill. I think they're going to take further testimony. There may be some amendments on the bill. So that's where the bill is right now, and it's another step forward in the progress. One of the things that I would say about it, there's also an annual increase that was put in an index that would be put in for the gas tax, so it would go up and keep up with inflation, which it hasn't been doing. In committee, that was amended to be no more than a penny a gallon per year, so it was capped at that amount. So I think that was to help appease some of the anti-tax folks. We'll see. I don't know what amendments yet are going to be offered on the bill, but the discussion's going. It's going well, but this is not going to be an easy bill to get passed, both in the House and I think also as it goes over to the Senate. So to sum it up, general agreement, we need to do something. We need to do something long-term. The need's there. It's how we get there that's important.
Kevin Berninger, let me bring you into the discussion. You testified during that hearing. If you could talk a little bit about some of the key points you emphasized, and again, where you envision things going from here as Mark outlined some of the next steps.
Thank you, Tom, and good morning, everyone. The key points that I tried to make is that right now our highway and road funding, the source of that funding is a tax on the purchase of fuel and gasoline and diesel fuel. And over time, the overall vehicle fleet, all the cars and trucks in the state of Indiana have become more and more fuel efficient, and so they can drive farther on a gallon of gas or a gallon of diesel than before, and so the tax paid per mile driven has gone down dramatically, 25% in the case of gasoline since the last time the tax rate was changed, and over 50% since 1988, which is the last time the diesel fuel taxes. And so we're losing purchasing power to provide roads, maintain roads and bridges, and if we're going to keep taxing the fuel source, then we've got to catch up, and that's a real need. I also presented data that showed the tax per mile driven. If we were at a tax rate equal to the purchasing power in 1970, when the gas tax rate was 8 cents per gallon, the current tax rate would be 40 cents per gallon, and that's not anywhere near what this bill doesn't go anywhere near that far, but it shows you how difficult this has been and how far behind we've fallen by continuing to tax gasoline and diesel fuel. This bill also raises registration fees on electric vehicles, who of course pay nothing to use the roads because they don't operate on gasoline and diesel fuel. And I made the point to the study committee in the fall that hopefully sooner rather than later, we need to rethink what source we're taxing and start to look at how heavy the vehicles are and how many miles do they drive, because that's really the proxy for damage to the roads versus fuel consumption.
For either Kevin or Mark, Mark referenced the fact House Ways and Means will take this up next week. Would you anticipate this moving to the House floor and trying to get it through the House earlier rather than later? Again, I ask that question posed whether we have the end of February deadline for the first half of the session. Would you expect it to go up to that period or maybe move to the whole House earlier?
I don't think it'll be the last bill that the House passes before the deadline for bills to pass the first House. You have to remember that I think it'll be earlier, in part because there's several major bills, but the big kahuna of all is the budget bill. And so I think you'll see this bill move before they move the budget bill out of the Ways and Means Committee into the floor.
I would echo that, and I think that it's not going to be the first one. I really think there's a feeling they want to make sure this is fully vetted in that House before they send it over to the Senate. So I would agree with what Kevin said. Let's just say it will be safe. Sometime before the end of the first half of the session, I believe it will successfully pass out of the House. But it's not going to be easy, and I'd also say we have very active grassroots on our website. We've sent that out to many of the members. We can include that with the information here. Please contact your legislator, especially as a state rep, and encourage them to support better road funding in Indiana.
We will send links to the grassroots site in our follow-up email today. You'll see additional information in our legislative report. And on this topic, many of our Indiana Chamber board members have been positively weighing in with some letters to the editor and other outreaches in their communities. We thank them for all their efforts. And legislators, as Mark said, need to hear from people on this important issue. Mark, before we let you go, your next stop today in a few minutes is a meeting of the policy committee of our Indiana Technology and Innovation Council, the group that formed here at the chamber last summer, working towards advancing policy in our technology, innovation, entrepreneurship areas. That group getting together to hear some updates on key priorities. One of those priorities regarding open data, something that was, again, heard in committee this week. Talk about that a little bit and where that stands.
The open data bill, which basically is about the taking the Management Performance Hub, which was created by executive order under Governor Pence when he was here, and they are taking state agency data, bringing it together, and making it so that is useful for a variety of purposes. It could be used for transparency. It could be used to help inform effectiveness of programs, help inform policymakers. And our bent on this is we want to make sure that it has external utility as well. So it's valuable to people who are trying to solve big issues, big problems, and create opportunities in Indiana. That bill was offered by Representative Ober. He amended the bill, taking an awful lot of the bill out. We are working with Representative Ober on an amendment that he's going to offer at the committee hearing next Tuesday, and we're trying to make sure that this bill has the maximum utility possible. One of the things that you don't want to do with an open data system like this, it's a very big, complex area. You don't want to boil the ocean with it. And so they are trying to keep it where it's building a solid foundation for what it can be, but build it out in a way that it's generating some successes in utility and usefulness as it builds out. So that's sort of a tension point on the bill right now, is how general do you have the bill and how prescriptive is the bill? And I think there's a balance there that we're trying to help achieve.
So more changes to come on that, and you said an additional hearing in committee this coming Tuesday?
That's correct, yes, at the Government Regulatory Reform Committee.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark. Let's turn to the subject of, I'm not sure if it was a lengthy hearing this week to rival the road funding, but a very, very important hearing on House legislation to raise the cigarette tax and take other efforts to help curb our smoking rates. We'll start with Mike Ripley, again, our lead person on this issue, and we'll bring Kevin in as he testified once again. But Mike, talk about that House Public Health Committee hearing, a rally that took place that day. Where's that legislation stand?
Yeah, there was a rally. The Alliance for Healthier Indiana held a rally in the late morning, early afternoon to rally the troops around the issue related to House Bill 1578. The bill has really four points that we've been pushing. First, there is $35 million annually would be appropriated for cessation and prevention of tobacco issues. Number two would be a cigarette tax increase. Currently, from the 0.995, in addition to that, would be $1.50. So would take a cigarette tax per pack to 2.495. Changing the age of smoking from 18 to 21. And then the final leg, which we've been working on for several years and have never been successful in even getting a hearing, and that is repealing the preferential treatment of smokers in Title 22, which generally is a labor issue. We were confident that we could get the bill passed. Kevin gave a great overview on the cost of businesses to businesses. Jim Mills, our chairman of our healthcare policy committee, testified about the preferential treatments, and other members of the alliance testified in favor. We were pretty confident we'd get a positive vote on it. We were surprised that it was 11-0 because we had we were sure there was going to be at least two no votes and possibly more. And those folks changed their mind and switched at the last minute and decided to vote for the bill. We also got, which was a little bit of a surprise, Jim Mills and I had talked about the preferential treatment, and we knew that that was a controversial issue for some of the members, and we had prepped him on how to answer that question. Never got any pushback whatsoever. The following day, I did talk to one of the members who did say it was controversial, but there was really little pushback on the bill altogether. A few questions, but it was. It looks like that they had a little plan before the bill or the hearing, and may have had their ducks in order. So the outcome was great. We were really pleased. Now the bill will go to Ways and Means, and a couple of those members that were on the Healthcare Policy Committee, they will be on Ways and Means, and so we'll see what happens there, and hopefully we'll get favorable reception.
Yeah, I think the bill could be heard in Ways and Means as early as next week, but could be the week after. I shared with the committee in my remarks that smoking costs Indiana businesses $3.2 billion a year in lost worker productivity and $2.9 billion a year in direct smoking-related healthcare costs, and it is truly bad for business in Indiana, as well as talking about the importance of these policy measures to curb smoking, particularly to squeeze down the pipeline of young people becoming smokers through raising the age and raising the tax in particular. And that's so important because cigarettes and tobacco products are very addictive, and we learned through research presented to our alliance this summer from the IU School of Public Health that the average person who successfully quits smoking has tried 8 to 10 times previously, and over half of the people in Indiana who smoke, so that's over 10% of our population, would like to quit but have not been able to do so yet. So if we can stop them from ever starting when they're young adults, we'll be way ahead of the game.
Mike, I ask you, who is opposed to this? Who's weighing in on the other side for various reasons?
The National Association of Tobacco Outlets and the Indiana Petroleum Marketing and Convenience Store Association. Those are opposed to it because they have the most impact and the most to lose.
I would describe that as the people who want to be able to continue to sell cheap cigarettes.
Well, one of the concerns certainly for retailers is with raising taxes is whether they'll lose some of those sales to out-of-state people across state lines to purchase their cigarettes. I noticed separately this week that in Ohio, Governor Kasich's budget bill includes a cigarette tax increase in Ohio. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
Mike is actually heading out to Bloomington to appear on a radio show later today to talk just about this issue in that community and talk about the cigarette tax. Before you have to leave for that, other issues you're working on, key updates for our listeners today?
Yeah, there was a pretty extensive labor committee meeting in the Senate this week. There was a discussion about misclassification of workers and cash being paid out, and that was specifically targeted for those construction companies that might be sometimes paying under the table. The Senator Talian had a bill to create an investigator in the Department of Labor and give some pretty onerous and draconian type responsibilities to this individual. I don't know that it didn't move. The opponents of the bill, including us, they ran out of time, didn't have time to talk about it. So I think it's going to come back for further discussion, but I don't expect that to move. But I think there are some legislators who think that we ought to probably start figuring out because they've been talking about this for several years. One other bill that we were opposed to the original version, but was able to get it to a summer study committee, and that is an idea of voluntary unpaid leave. The Indiana Women's Commission has, which is a branch of the administration, the executive branch the governor's office, they actually applied for a $200,000 grant, federal grant, to study this issue and propose potential solutions for a voluntary paid leave program. We told them that we would oppose anything that is expanded, whether it was at the federal level or the state level, of the FMLA, and that's what this is directed at. There might be a narrow window that we could talk about, but it had to be based upon the private sector and free market and couldn't be any mandates whatsoever on business. And what the bill actually does, and it passed the committee pretty much unanimously, it's just to take that report from the Women's Commission and then send that to the interim study committee on labor and employment, and that's basically what.
Thank you, Mike. Again, for our members on the phone, we encourage you to weigh in with your questions and comments at 01, or excuse me, to weigh in. Let's move to the third of the major priorities that we continue to talk to you about for this legislative session. That involves expanding our pre-K pilot program. The first two issues we talked about, legislation has been focused on the House. In pre-K, we have similar bills moving in both the House and the Senate. We've had hearings the last 2 weeks on those. Carol Auslander, again, give our listeners a kind of an overview of the two bills, what some of the differences are, and where we're headed on pre-K.
Sure. Well, you're right, Tom. The week before this one, the Senate Education Committee heard Senate Bill 276. Chairman Cruz typically hears the bill in committee and then will do amend and vote in a subsequent committee. Senator Holdman is the author of Senate Bill 276 that was heard last week, and he is working on a substantial amendment that is taking him an LSA in conjunction with discussions with us here at the chamber, as well as the All In for a Pre-K Coalition, to significantly expand more of what he's planning on doing with the bill. The Senate Bill 276 just duplicates the existing pre-K pilot program, which is currently in five counties: Marion, Allen, Lake, Vanderburg, and Jackson County.
Sure.
Thank you. And expanding it to five more counties with $10 million. What we are expecting to see in this amendment moving forward is removing the county requirement for expansion. So if there is a community or a group of providers that are ready to have a high quality, level three or level four path to quality providers that are ready, they can apply for these grant dollars through FFSA. There will be some language in there regarding being able to use some of the appropriations for capacity building dollars. So eligible providers that currently are level three and four that want to add more classrooms, add another teacher to expand, or if there are providers out there that are not yet on path to quality, or they're level one or level two and want to expand to three and four, the highest levels, they would have access to some of those grant dollars. The Senate bill keeps it at 127% of federal poverty level as the income threshold. And so there's some differences between the House bill and the Senate bill. We expect that the Senate bill will have a vote on February 15th, at which time it will then be recommitted to Senate Appropriations Committee, where I expect we'll see some further tweaks from Senator Kenley. But it's moving along in the process, and we're gaining a lot of momentum. Similarly, the House bill was heard this week in House Education Committee. I don't know that our hearing lasted as long as road funding, but it started at 8:30 in the morning, had to take a break for session and caucus, and then back to session, and but we went until 7 p.m. that night, so it was almost 12 hours of working on some of these issues. House Bill 1004, which is authored by Representative Bob Boehning, Representative Holly Sullivan, and Representative Justin Moet, actually has $0 in it. They're going to take care of the funding mechanism through the House version of the budget. It plans to double to 10 counties. We're hearing that might save 10 counties, that might expand once we know some of the revenue forecast. Well, one of the issues that we're trying to push amongst the legislators is that simply doubling the counties and doubling the appropriation, the math actually doesn't quite work because four of the five original pilot counties are the most populated counties in the state. So the next five counties will be smaller. We know they will be. And so their $10 million might actually be able to be spread out further to perhaps seven or eight counties. So we're working on trying to keep that message moving. There will be capacity building dollar grants available. The income threshold is different in the House bill. Theirs is significantly higher. We've been pushing to move it from 127% of federal poverty to 185%. percent of federal poverty, which aligns with the free and reduced lunch level. Our feeling is that the family cannot afford to send their child with the $250 a day for lunch. They probably can't afford quality pre-K. So, but the House actually goes even further than 185%. They're going to 200% of free and reduced lunch, or 150% of free and reduced lunch. So perhaps we'll kind of get somewhere in the middle. But they we're working on some amendments there as well. It will be eligible for second reading amendments and discussion on as early as Monday, and potential final vote out of the House. It will not be resubmitted at this point to Ways and Means because there is no fiscal in it.
Well, the first two bills we talked about, transportation and the cigarette tax, again, as we said, are originating in the House. Kevin, I'll ask you this, and then Carol, you can weigh in. It's certainly not unusual, and maybe even a positive sign of the tremendous interest in this legislation, to have two bills moving in each House that will eventually find a compromise. Is that correct? And we've seen that on a number of important pieces of legislation through the years.
Well, certainly there is significant interest in this legislation. The question is, money and how you fund it, and I think the legislator, the fiscal leaders of the General Assembly are, could argue, being appropriately cautious because they didn't get a real positive revenue forecast in December, particularly this current fiscal year, which runs through June 30th. The estimates of state revenues were downgraded by $300 million, and that's kind of the equivalent of a punch in the stomach, and causes them to move forward cautiously. We certainly are committed at the chamber to expanding ultimately preschool opportunities that are educationally oriented of a high quality level to all low-income disadvantaged families. That won't happen this year, but we want to push it and expand it as far as we can this legislative session and then build on that in the future. But frankly, the extent to which that happens may depend on what happens in some other pieces of legislation, in particular the anti-smoking bill, which has a $300 million cigarette tax increase in it that could provide some additional funding for pre-K if that's how the legislature chooses to use those resources, and, of course, if they enact that legislation.
Carol, the provision you mentioned of ultimately whether it's determined that expansion would take place in a set number of prescribed counties as opposed to areas that have programs that are up and running. Talk about that a little bit. Is that kind of a little bit of a new take on it, and looking at programs that are ready to go instead of going to these certain counties?
You know, I think it all depends on how the bill is structured. If the bill is structured like the Senate, where it's not necessarily keeping the income threshold, then it makes sense to expand places around the state. If we are increasing the income threshold, it might make more sense to do it in specific areas. What we do know, for example, Vandenberg County, one of the pilot programs, at the 127% of federal income threshold, all but 43 four-year-old Hoosiers at that income threshold are being served by the On My Way pre-K pilot program. So giving them an additional $1 or $2 million, they're not going to be able to spend money. They need to increase the income threshold because they feel that they can serve probably another 300 or more students if they do that. Otherwise, they're only going to be able to, it will be a very small number. And we don't want to be caught in the situation where we're actually have money and not being able to spend it. So, that's why it's important to also start increasing some of the capacity so that we have more room in other areas of the state, because there are many counties in the state that don't have any level 3 or level 4 rated providers in their county. So it's something that's really, really important that we're going to look at. We're in a unique situation. I've been working on childcare and pre-K issues even before I joined the chamber 2 years ago. You know, 5 years ago, a lot of the discussion was on the importance of early childhood education and why we spent a lot of time lobbying legislators and the governor's office on why it's important. The we're not having to do that as much anymore. Our focus now is not why we should be doing it, but how much and to what extent we will be expanding, which is a great problem, a great success problem. I think we really move the needle. So the real question will be when the April revenue forecast comes out, just like Kevin said, as to how much money will be available. And what we've been pushing legislators day in and day out is to be able to spend as much as we can to put more of these low-income four-year-olds, Hoosier kids, into high-quality seats without, you know, bankrupting our state. So that's what we're working on, and we're very fortunate that both the House and the Senate leaders, Republican and Democrat, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the superintendent, were, everybody believes in this. So it, we're very, very fortunate in a great situation.
I'm holding in my hand our first edition of the legislative agenda for this year, a nice 39-page document that outlines chamber position on all key pieces of legislation that impact businesses. And again, we'll link to that in our follow-up email, and you can also access it through this afternoon's legislative report. But that document and our activity at the State House always includes a number of additional education-related bills. Carol asked you to just touch on a few, if you would, of important education bills and their status.
Absolutely, and I think all of them are being heard next week, so it's perfect timing that you asked this question. One of the Superintendent of Public Instruction appointment bills will be heard next week in Senate Labor and Pension, Senate Bill 179. Again, the chamber has had a longstanding policy on believing that the governor should be able to directly appoint their superintendent of public instruction. And in fact, Governor Holcomb made that one of his priority legislative priorities this session, and Speaker Bosma, the only bill that he is carrying this session, happens to be the House version of this. But Senate Bill 179, we will be supportive of, although, however, it does not allow for the appointment by the governor until 2025, so it would allow 8 more years of being able to have, so it will be one more election cycle 4 years from now. In my opinion, I don't think there's any reason to wait 8 years. The superintendent is not term limited, so it's not like we're expecting the current superintendent to have the chance to run for 2 concurrent terms. So we will raise that issue in committee this week. But again, we're really happy that the legal will be moving forward on that. And there are Senator Bassler has another bill that I believe is 4 years. And again, the speaker has his bill, which I'm, given the fact that he's the speaker, I'm sure it will be heard in the next few weeks. Also in House Education next week, we have House Bill 1003, which is the student assessment bill. And what this will do is this is kind of a culmination of the ISTEP panel that met all summer and fall. And what it will do is it will sunset the current ISTEP in the summer of 2018. The original statute passed last year was going to sunset it this year. However, many national experts came and spoke to the panel over the summer and stated that it would take a minimum of 2 years to develop and to test and market a new exam. So this is going to push back the sunset of the current ISTEP for 1 year, and will develop what is called iLearn. And I can't remember exactly what that acronym stands for.
Oh, we don't want to know what it stands for. It just sounds good. iLearn.
Right.
Can't beat the name.
I suggested iSmart, but that one didn't make the cut. But it a lot of what will be in House Bill 1003 was developed by the ISTEP mission that met over the summer, which was made up primarily of educators and administrators, but we also had our own Marilyn Moran Townsend as a business representative to that panel, who really worked on trying to collaborate with the group on creating something that will align with our college and career-ready standards. So we have that bill that's going to be heard next week. There's also House Bill 1007, which I think will be very interesting, on education course action program, which will allow different courses of all different levels to be developed and disseminated throughout the state in different ways using technology. So if there's this might potentially help some small and rural schools that may not be able to carry an AP physics class, things like that, that these courses can be developed and delivered using different technology. And then we also have House Bill 1008, which is a workforce development bill that creates a tax credit for currently drafted incumbent workers. I believe it will be adopted for incumbent workers and new hires. For training purposes, it will also audit many of the workforce development programs that are currently being used throughout our state that are in 9 different agencies, spending a lot of state dollars and federal dollars. It's going to audit them based on outcomes, and there's been a significant amount of collaboration between the Department of Workforce Development, Department of Education, Commission of Higher Education, Representative Todd Houston turning that bill, and we've got our hands in that and trying to make a great bill, but it sounds like they've got a significant amount of support and collaboration moving forward.
Time for me to insert a shameless promotion as we're talking about education and workforce. That will be the focus of our March 8th Biz Voice, and I'll be available the last week of February, both in the mail and online. And we have one-on-one interviews with both Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, as well as Ivy Tech Community College President Sue Elsford. So those, among other stories, will be very interesting reads. I encourage you to take a look at that in Biz Voice. Bill Waltz, we've heard the, I'm going to throw a minor curveball at you, but one that you will be able to handle with ease. We've heard the House Ways and Means Committee mentioned a couple times. That's the next stop for road funding or cigarette tax increase. The committee, which you've worked and followed for a number of years, obviously in the process of budget hearings. Give our listeners a little bit of insight into that committee. It's larger. It has to take a different focus with its broad kind of number of issues. Talk a little bit about that committee, if you would.
Okay. Well, first of all, I have to start at the top with the chairman, the all-powerful, you might say, the chairman of Ways and Means and the chairman of the Senate, the corresponding committees in the Senate, whether it's appropriations and tax and fiscal. Actually, you know, they hold a lot of power, the purse strings. Chairman Brown in Ways and Means has proven himself to be a great guy, I'd have to say, start there, but a very well-respected across the aisle, you know, and by, you know, members of the committee from both sides. He conducts the committee's transactions in a very open way. They have a lot to deal with. He has his lieutenants, as I often refer to them, that tend to carry, you know, bills in kind of siloed areas that are probably ones that he, you know, has blessed. And, you know, whether it be, you know, one person, Representative Thompson, pretty much handles the school funding issues. He has a local government czar in Dan Leonard, another great legislator. Todd Houston, a little newer to the committee from Fishers, has been handling a lot of big, important, significant tax bills in a variety of areas. And I could go on down the list. His vice chair, Mike Karakoff from Kokomo, has, you know, been his right-hand man in a lot of ways as well and conducted the, you know, well, actually handles the proceedings when the chairman may or may not be there for some reason, steps out. There's some dirty folks on the other side of the aisle.
Yeah, it just seems from the external view that is a committee that meets and meets and meets and meets because it has so many important issues to deal with.
Yeah, if you you know, those legislators deserve a lot of credit. They are find themselves in marathon meetings, particularly later in each half of the session. They have to deal with a lot. They have to understand a lot. That committee, because everybody else is on other committees that meet on Wednesdays regularly, forces that committee to meet upon adjournment, sometimes, you know, early Monday morning, odd long hours. So they're all to be commended for the service they provide.
Let's talk about a specific issue, one that is part of our Indiana Vision 2025, not a new topic, online sales tax, but there's a piece of legislation at the state level that's important to this big picture.
Yeah, where to begin with that one, Tom? Senate Bill 545, authored by Senator Kinley, who's been sort of a champion in working in the area of collecting or attempting to find ways to collect or have what they refer to as remote sellers or e-tailers sometimes, people who conduct their business primarily online and make sales through the Internet to Indiana purchasers. Those people, in many cases, unless the company who's conducting that activity happens to also have a physical presence in this state, they are not legally required to collect sales tax. The purchaser is supposed to pay what's referred to as a use tax on those purchases, but that's just largely not complied with by taxpayers across the state, so a large volume of sales tax, it goes uncollected. Estimates vary quite a bit, and they change depending on, you know, whether those companies, again, you know, may have some taxable nexus, as they refer to it in the state, but the number is probably somewhere maybe a little under $100 million to easily, it could well be over $200 million. The estimates are in that range. So this bill that Senator Kinley has brought forward is, it's legally complicated. I have to say, you sort of need to be, I think, a constitutional lawyer, maybe a tax lawyer or a civil procedure lawyer to put it all together. And the reason for that is what he's trying to do is put a law in place that will do a few things. It'll hopefully push the Supreme Court maybe to take a case that's making its way through the federal court system out of South Dakota. Several states are passing legislation that is modeled after the South Dakota law. In fact, this bill is in major terms identical. So that if the court takes that case, this law will be in effect, in place, almost immediately, and all that you'd have to do is have a court, say, Indiana state court, via a process, a declaratory judgment would be issued that says this out-of-state seller meets the terms of the statute, and the federal courts have deemed that, you know, this acceptable to require, allow states to require the tax collection in those cases. And once that happens, they could immediately begin collecting the tax.
So we're being a little preemptive here. Instead of waiting for a court decision to happen, which often is the case, and then acting, we're putting something in place. If that court decision occurs, we're ready to move forward.
Yeah, and there's actually another motivation, which is a little trickier, but the law would allow retroactive collection to July 1 of 2017. So they're trying to prompt a lot of these folks to voluntarily comply. Say, look, you know, this, they're kind of looking at writing on the wall, this could well be legalized soon enough. So they would just go ahead and start collecting voluntarily to the state. So I think he's trying to motivate some people to do that as well.
We're going to hit a few other issues here and go on to water and energy also. But again, we have about 15 minutes remaining. open to your questions and comments. Simply hit 01 on your phone. Bill, there's some other interesting pieces of tax legislation that kind of fly under the radar, so to speak, but I know you always are keeping a close eye and advocating on those for our members. You want to touch on a few of those today?
Sure. So you might get your pencil out and write down a few bill numbers if you're interested in these areas. The first one, another big item in virus that's identified in the 2025 Vision 2025 document has to do with the personal property tax, and there is a bill that addresses that. It's 1311, actually authored by Representative Leonard, who I mentioned a minute ago. It reduces the 30% floor. I think a lot of these folks have heard me talk about that before, but that's a reference to the level of assessment of personal property or machinery and equipment, so that it has to be, it's an arbitrary, totally artificial standard that was put in place years ago that says you can never tax that equipment at less than 30% of its original purchase price, even though it's in many, many cases depreciated from a market standpoint well below that. 57% of the returns that are filed now actually are subject to that floor, that 30% floor. So we're talking about a lot of people. We're also talking about a significant amount of money over it. So it's structured in a way to deal with that. Incrementally, it would reduce that 30% floor by 1% each year for 10 years. Eventually getting it down to a 20% floor. It would have what I would say is still a pretty nominal effect of somewhere around $25 million a year statewide. And half of that, roughly, is shifted to other taxpayers. That's a bill that affects a lot of people. We would like to see that discussion continue. A couple others real fast. If you deal, if you're an accountant, I speak to the accountants and tax managers out there, or the people listening, talk to those folks. Senate Bill 515 is the Department of Revenue's bill. Every year they have an agency bill. Might want to keep an eye on that one. Has a lot of various provisions in it. It may end up incorporating provisions that are in 440, Senate Bill 440, which is a bill that we've advocated at the chamber that we think has some good procedural changes in it that would be taxpayer friendly. Property tax appeals seems to be an area, subject area that gets addressed every year. Senate Bill 501. Is something of a recodification of the procedures applying to property tax appeals. So if you're interested in that area, that would be the bill to watch. I think those are probably the big ones. Tom, I just have to say that after all the discussion on the budget, the bills that were mentioned from the outset, the 1002, the transportation bill, and Mike, or the cigarette tax bill, 1578, Carol's talked about the pre-K funding. Those are all big dollar items and will all impact the budget in different ways. You know, some of them bring in a lot, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, that's a bit of the unique aspect of this session that we talked about a little bit last month with these major financial decisions at play in these top pieces of legislation.
So the Ways and Means Committee has to kind of tally up all the other bills that are affecting either expenditures or revenue losses. And there's many others besides those that we just mentioned. So they've got a pretty interesting and complicated task of looking at how they all interplay and when the money comes in and where it's going this year.
So those key leaders you talked about on both the House and Senate side, those calculators might be working a little extra overtime or something. Let's move on to the energy and environmental area. Greg Ellis, I promise you won't always fall last in the order here because we make our way around the table. Your predecessor used to think that, Vince Griffin, used to think that was a good thing. That meant nobody was kind of paying attention, and he was able to move legislation through the process of the less notice of things. But update our listeners on some of the things you're working on in those areas.
Well, I'll try to follow in Vince's footsteps. I thought maybe you guys would run out of time, and I would just throw my name out there and let people call me. But on the energy and environment side, this session is what I would call light and on the environment side. There's been a lot more focus on energy and utility matters. The big one that along the Vision 2025 plan was the water infrastructure, sustainability, the cost of water. There's quite a few bills along those lines, so I'll try to run through them pretty quickly. Senator Charbonneau has two bills, Senate Bill 416, which was it is going to establish a water infrastructure fund to aid in some of the replacements, matching federal money, grants, things like that. As Bill said, the budget is a big issue this session, so there's no funding mechanism in this bill. It's going to establish it, and then they're going to start working on funding if it passes into law. The partner bill to that is what I call Senate Bill 511, which would put certain requirements and information gathering under the Indiana Finance Authority and take that out of some of the other agencies, the IORC, IDEM, State Department of Health, DNR, some of the local government, and just for more efficient control of that. Both of those bills passed out of committee unanimously. They went through third reading, and they've been sent over to the House. Along those lines, there have been a couple other bills that have popped up just this week. There's House Bill 1519, which is an infrastructure development zone that municipal can ask certain water companies to bring infrastructure to areas that they expect to be developed but aren't, which is different than current law. Under current law, it has to be the term used and useful. There's been some pushback on that, so I actually this morning got hard copies of amendments to that, and then the partner bill with that, which is House Bill 1551, which is water supply development, where the water companies could actually go out and replace service lines, which are currently the responsibility of the landowner. Both of those bills have been gutted from where they were initially. My understanding is they're going to be consolidated into one, and they're going to be significantly different. I have to review those today, and they're going to be referred to House Utilities hearing next week. The other big bill that I've been watching, and I think most of you are aware of, they're interested in energy, is Senate Bill 309. That is what I've classified all along as a compromise bill. Some of the utilities that I've talked to say we're giving up too much. Some of the industry I've talked to said we're not getting enough out of this. I've been prodded by both the House and Senate utilities chairs that we need to try to get the people on opposite sides of the fence to a compromise. And I was kind of warned that if this bill doesn't go through, if this bill gets killed, the other energy bills in the pipeline will get killed. There's, for instance, there's House Bill 1172, which is competitive procurement, which I believe INDIAC is pushing, which is considerably different than 309.
Greg, you mentioned INDIAC. Explain that.
I'm sorry. That's a group that some of our members belong to. It's the Indiana Industrial Energy Consumers Group.
Good job with the acronym.
That's an area that I've dealt with in my past position as an ALJ at the Utility Commission. And basically, my take on this is I'm recommending that we support this bill because if we don't, we're back to stalemate, and it will be continuing and expensive litigations for both sides.
And you're saying there's a pretty strong message from the legislators, it's time to compromise.
Yes, they said it's time to compromise or don't come back with anything until you get a compromise.
Tom, I might add that Greg's done a, I'll use the word masterful, job in helping to pull these disparate parties together, get them to talk about the elements that are in this, this legislation, and particularly given that it's his first session with us, he's been kind of given a difficult task. And we don't know yet whether this legislation is going to pass, but it would, if it did, it would certainly be better than the status quo. And we're hopeful, and just to be able to get this far at this point in the session, I think speaks well for Greg's cajoling and negotiating skills.
Thanks, Kevin. One of the other things, Bill, that I don't see going anywhere, but I think is of interest to our members, is House Bill 1529, which is Demand-Side Management Program is what it's titled as. That was that's a bill by Representative Dvorak, which would make demand-side management participation mandatory by all industry. Currently, the law allows them to opt out of these programs if they think that it's beneficial to them. And that was a big deal, I believe, two sessions ago, and that would reverse all of that. On the environmental side, I received a couple calls this week about House Bill 1234, which is titled the Storage of Agriculture Ammonia. I talked to Representative Leahy, the author, the State Chemist Office, and IDEM. The concern was that this would apply to all storage of ammonia, and that's not the case. It would only apply to storage of agriculture ammonia that's stored in one place longer than 30 days. It would be specific to agriculture use, so I wanted to get that out there.
Greg, you mentioned the titles of a couple of those bills. I always find that interesting because sometimes the titles aren't always reflective of what's in the bills.
Right, right. The other one of interest that we talked about in our Environmental Policy Committee meeting earlier this year is Senate Bill 421. It's the above-ground storage tank of chemicals. The registration was created by Senate Bill 312 last year, or 2 years ago, I'm sorry. But that had some issues that were identified as burdensome and duplicative record keeping. And that this is a fix of that. It got postponed, but my understanding is the Environmental Rule Board Chair, Beth Gard, set everybody straight in this moving forward. So once again, if you guys have questions about these, feel free to call me because I've run through them pretty quickly. But those are the highlights, and there are many other bills that we're watching, but we're probably going to win.
Thanks, Greg. Kevin, I've got one closing question for you as we wrap up. I did some quick math and came up with 223 bills in our legislative agenda. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, that is just a fraction of the overall number of bills. I'm not going to ask you how many there are total, but you go through every piece of legislation that's filed in order to help our team be prepared for what they need to do. Just talk about give the readers a sense of just the massive amount of legislation that is out there being considered.
Between House and Senate, I would estimate that it's over 1,000 bills.
We talked maybe about 1,200, I believe.
Right. 1,200. And so I go through the digest of all those bills. That's what I've been doing over the first 3 to 4 weeks of the session, and I get the job of assigning those to our lobbying team by subject area based on what each member of the team covers, and many of them are obvious, the tax bills, whatever bill, but some of them are in gray areas, some of them have overlap, some of them we want, maybe a tax bill for education, so Bill and Carol will work on that. Go through and do all those assignments, and then our lobbying team takes the bills assigned to them and runs those bills through the filter of our board-established policy positions to say, okay, which bills do we really care about? Which ones do we have a policy position on, and what does that position say about this bill? And That goes into the document that you referenced, our legislative agenda, which is specific positions on bills that we care about, specific bills. That's shared with the legislators, so they have no excuse not to know where the chamber stands on a given issue. And then, of course, that's supplemented with our day-to-day lobbying at the State House, both individually with legislators and testimony committee hearings. And then at the end of the process, we keep score and say what percentage of the time did legislators, each individual legislator, vote with us on the bills that we said were important to the business community across the state. And that goes into another document called our legislative vote analysis, which is the scorecard of how each legislator did. And for incumbent legislators, that becomes the main input into our PAC, Indiana Business for Responsive Government, for us to determine whether we're going to endorse or go after incumbent legislators to try to replace them with a better voting member of the General Assembly.
Well, that leads to my closing point, that if you think that Kevin is out running around kind of leading the glamorous life when he's not working at the chamber, he's actually home in his office reading through bill digests for a number of weeks. So that's how early January and much of January is spent.
That's how the weekends and nights have been spent.
With that, we're going to wrap up today's call. Thank you to all members of our advocacy team. A few reminders. We will return on 4 weeks from today on Friday, March 3rd, which will be the midpoint of the session. We'll have a wrap-up of what's taken place up to that point. A couple of things I've referenced, legislative report. Look for that this afternoon and every Friday throughout the session. Again, we'll have links to the legislative directory. Legislative agenda for those that still need of legislative directories. And finally, our legislative dinner, March 14th, featuring Ann Compton. Information available on that. Kevin, final point.
Those of you that are listening that are interested and supportive of House Bill 1578, which is the anti-smoking bill, the governor needs to hear from you because we're getting feedback. We're trying to get him on board and support this legislation publicly. Having a little trepidation, not surprisingly, because it does include, among those 4 points that Mike Ripley outlined, a cigarette tax increase, and is a little skittish about supporting a bill that has a tax increase in it here in his first year in office. But it would be very helpful to the ultimate passage of this legislation if we could get the governor on board. So I would ask all of you out there that are interested in this, please give the governor's office a call and register your support. They've told us they need to hear from business to get him to be more comfortable. And that phone number is area code 317-232-4567. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, and look for additional information in our communications grassroots regarding that. Thank you for joining us today, for your support of the Chamber. Have a wonderful Friday and weekend.
Thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All participants may now disconnect.